Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol. For this first episode, I was delighted to get to chat with both Dr. Peter Rice and Dr. Alistair McGilchrist. Dr. Rice was an addiction psychiatrist who chaired SHAP, Scottish Health Action on Alcohol Problems, when it was first set up in 2006. And Dr. McGilchrist, a retired hepatologist, is SHAP's current chair. They were able to give me a bit of an overview of Scotland's alcohol consumption and harms and what SHAP have been trying to do about it. It was exciting to hear that Scotland was actually the first country in the world to introduce national minimum unit pricing, for example. We spoke about how informing ourselves helped engender hope and tackled our own stigma, and also how we need to use our legitimate voices as doctors to shape policy debates upstream of our clinical experience. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did, and there are links to various resources we mentioned on the podcast website. Hello to you both.
Hello, thanks Rachel. I'm Alistair. I'm a retired liver specialist from Edinburgh and currently chair of SHAP, Scottish Health Action on Alcohol Problems. I'm delighted to be here to discuss a very important issue to primary care.
Peter here, Peter Rice. Yeah, I'm also a retired addiction psychiatrist, but I still work in policy at various levels, a local alcohol charity. I do work with SHAP Scotland, and I'm also involved in work at UK and international level, and I'm looking forward to the discussions.
Peter, maybe if I could start with you. What is SHAP? When did it start? And what are you guys about?
Well, we're a partnership of the Medical Royal Colleges and faculties in Scotland, and we grew out of what was called the Scottish Intercollegiate Group on Alcohol, which was really just an interest group of people who were concerned about alcohol, and that was psychiatrists like myself, physicians and gastroenterologists like Alistair, public health doctors, general practitioners.
When was that? Was that some time ago now?
SIGA probably goes back into the 1990s, and SHAP was formed really to, if you like, professionalise that interest group. So that was a great discussion group. We met interested people. Mm. We ran good events in a pretty traditional medical education-y kind of way. But there was some quite alarming epidemiology coming out about alcohol harm in Scotland. And the co-chairs of SIGA, as it was at that time, was Professor Peter Brunt, which would be a familiar name to anyone from Aberdeen, where the postgrad centre is named after him now, and Dr. Bruce Ritson, who's a psychiatrist here in Edinburgh, decided that we needed a director, we needed policy staff and so on to back up what the clinicians were doing. Mm. And they effectively made a bid to the Scottish Government in 2006 to appoint a director and some staff to work with the clinicians, and things, I think it's fair to say, really took off at that point.
That's very interesting to hear. So I understand that you were an addiction psychiatrist, is that right? What other doctors were involved? Did you have any GPs in your interest group?
Yes, we did. Dr. Richard Watson, who's still active in this field, a GP in Cambuslang, was in at the heart of the formation from primary care. It's interesting, this won't be a surprise to your listeners perhaps, it's a little bit different, or it was a bit different for consultants compared to general practitioners. Maybe it didn't always feel like it to consultants, but we had a little bit of flexibility in our timetable, right? Can you get to Edinburgh in 2 weeks' time for a meeting on Wednesday afternoon? And quite often you could manage to do that. General practice isn't like that. You don't need me to tell you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there needed to be funding for general practice engagement and to employ locums and so on. So it's not impossible, but it's a little bit more work to get primary care involved. But it's hugely important. So we were able to do that for SHAP and also for other related activities that we've undertaken that have you know, needed primary care specifically to be very involved.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear you mindful of our audience. And you definitely have played well to the audience there, because that is true that we really don't have any flexibility built into our days. And it's really nice to hear you recognise that. I think you used to be the head of SHAP, and now that's you, Alistair, is that right? What's a retired gastroenterologist doing heading SHAP?
That's a very reasonable question, Rachel. But I mentioned at the start that my field within gastroenterology was very much liver-based. And it won't surprise any of you to know that the vast majority of my patients, their liver disease was a result of alcohol. And so I suppose I got a little bit interested in lifting your eyes up from the bedside to the wider issue. Mm. And it's kind of a slightly bittersweet fact that nearly all liver disease is eminently preventable. The big three for liver disease are alcohol, fatty liver, that's obesity and related diabetes, and viral hepatitis, which is often a lifestyle issue. So public health measures to prevent liver disease in the first place are by far the most effective way for patients not to have the liver disease and the dreadful illnesses and deaths which I was dealing with every day. And so I became aware of the existence of SHAP and joined it kind of as a sleeping partner when I was working, to be honest. But now that I'm retired, I'm taking a much more active role and very much enjoying the to and fro of trying to implement effective policies and also to inform better the profession and the public.
It actually makes total sense to me, Alistair, that after a career looking after people with alcoholic liver disease, you've decided to go upstream in your retirement. It makes total sense. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation here in Scotland regarding alcohol?
Yes. Is the glass half full or half empty? That's a very poor pun, sorry. but the in the days when Peter was talking about the formation of SHAP in the mid-2000s, there was the peak, if you like, of the alcohol epidemic. There was a dramatic rise in alcohol deaths. And if you're talking about deaths that are directly due to alcohol, it's alcohol-specific deaths, the vast majority of these are, in fact, alcoholic liver disease, right up my street. Now, things have improved since then, partly due to the sort of measures which SHAP and the Scottish Government helped to introduce then, but it's a bit of a roller coaster. I'm sure we'll come on later to talk about policies such as minimum unit pricing. That was enacted in law in 2012, but it took till 2018 to actually get the law implemented in the retail trade. And of course, by the time 2018 came along, just 2 years later, we had the COVID pandemic. And sadly, COVID, and this is not just a Scottish phenomenon, this is a worldwide phenomenon, had a dramatically bad effect on alcohol consumption and subsequent alcohol harm. So things were improving and improving more rapidly as a result of MUP, but in recent years, deaths have risen again. If one's looking for one glimmer of hope, they've risen less rapidly and less fully in Scotland than they have else in comparable countries such as England, which doesn't have MUP. But in the last year, those deaths have plateaued, but we're still seeing over 1,000 deaths a year from alcohol-specific deaths. And probably if you take account of deaths which are related to alcohol, such as some cancers and some heart disease, there's around three or four times that. So maybe around 4,000 deaths a year are directed due to alcohol.
So if I've understood correctly, Alistair, we have more deaths in Scotland due to alcohol than England, but they are getting worse at a higher rate than us. Is that right?
That's right. We still top the league, but they're coming up a close second.
We need to know where we stand in relation to England, of course. And this concept of alcohol-specific deaths versus alcohol-contributory deaths, or I don't know if there's a better way to say that, I've read that actually the deaths due to cancer that have been contributed by alcohol probably outweigh the deaths due to alcohol liver disease. Is that right?
Yeah, speaking as a liver doctor, I was stunned when I saw that data. You know, I think I was not alone as a clinician in not really viewing alcohol as a major risk factor for cancer. But in fact, it is. And for some quite common cancers, such as breast cancer and colorectal cancer. So even if it's only contributing to a minority, the total number of cases is quite quite large. And as you say, there's quite convincing European data suggesting that if you take alcohol-related deaths, that's deaths where alcohol plays a part rather than the only cause, cancer accounts for around 30% of those deaths and liver disease only around 20%.
Yeah, if you look at the alcohol harms across the lifespan, breaks down really into three groups. That in young people, you know, under 30, it's trauma and mental health deaths. Suicide, violence, road accidents. Mm. But actually, the road accident deaths, for instance, in Scotland are probably less than 20 a year.
Okay.
Well over 800 liver disease deaths a year.
Yeah.
So some of these impacts get disproportionate, I think.
Yeah, that does surprise me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in young people, it's kind of...
The mental health.
Trauma and mental health. Mm. In midlife, it's liver disease and a bit of cardiovascular disease. And in later life, it's cancer. So you really have these kind of three different life cycles. But the liver disease burden is very substantial because they're relatively early deaths compared to cancer deaths. So if you look at working life years lost, for instance, to alcohol harm, that's very substantial compared to working life years lost to cancers.
Okay, yeah, I think I've got that alcohol is killing people in their 50s from liver disease, mm-hmm. and it's contributing to cancers maybe later on in life. And it's probably contributing to a lot more than we realise. I did look at a very good video on the Institute for Alcohol Studies, which I think you're part of, Peter, and they have a very compelling video. I don't know if it was Cancer Research UK or the Institute of Alcohol Studies that made that video with a professor based here in Edinburgh, where, you know, they spell out the seven known cancers that alcohol is a risk factor for, and in addition, maybe pancreatic cancer as well. And they have this figure that 1 in 10 breast cancers may well be due to alcohol. Is that right?
Yes. And those really were the findings of some very large epidemiological studies. The breast cancer one's a good example of that. The Million Women study, and it was led by Oxford in a very large nurses study in the USA. Mm. And it was really only once you got those very large studies that the breast cancer risk came through. Mm. So I think one of the differences clearly was something like alcohol-related liver disease is you're never going to be able to see, even if you wanted to, this breast cancer was caused by alcohol. It doesn't.
Wondering how they worked that out.
Or this colon cancer. No, so it's increasing your risk factor as your alcohol consumption goes up. So, yes, the epidemiology of these alcohol attributable deaths, as they're described, is more complicated. Mm-hmm. The Scottish estimates are that will increase the number of deaths to about 3 or 4 times the number of alcohol-specific deaths. But the importance of alcohol-specific deaths, apart from, you know, liver disease, you know, being important in its own right, is that it's a pretty accurate measure. It's a very good barometer. Mm-hmm. And if things are going up with alcohol-related liver disease, they will be going up with other things. And it's not just health impacts, of course, there's huge numbers of social impacts. But if you went to your average sheriff court and said, you know, how many alcohol cases did you see last year? They would say many, 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 but wouldn't be able to give you a number.
Yeah.
So the health indicators are very important, and liver disease is really the canary in the coal mine, if you like. So it's such an important measure for, you know, how a population's doing, because you can get it quite quickly. And it's a pretty reliable indicator.
That makes total sense to me, actually. And thinking about alcohol here in Scotland, I've read that, you know, over 20% of Scots are drinking 14 units or above per week. So, you know, 1 in 5 of our patients are drinking to what they call hazardous or harmful levels. But, you know, who is drinking the most here in Scotland, and who are the people that we need to be most mindful of in terms of alcohol? Is it still men, or is that a stereotype?
I'll maybe have a start on this one, and Alistair can join in. The gender ratio really hasn't changed much. Mm. There's a lot of interest in women's drinking, a lot of interest in marketing to women, which has been quite extensive, and they are seen as a growing market by the industry. But actually the ratio hasn't really changed. The big change has been in age profile, with the rising rates of harm in older people, including the over 65s. And that wasn't a particularly popular message when you go to politicians or newspaper editors or whatever, you know, mostly in their 50s and 60s. They were quite happy to think that it was the teenagers who were in the early 20s who were the problem here. But that was just not where the demographics go. There's been quite a big decline in young people's drinking. We could talk about that in a minute if you like. But the message that this is an older people's issue. And the other thing that's clear is we move from being a pub drinking country to being a home drinking country. 85% of our alcohol sales are now in the off-trade, and that's dominated by the supermarkets. So as one of our politicians said during the committee hearings for minimum unit prices, what's going on behind the net curtains of, you know, Bear's Den and Broughty Ferry and Morningside that really matters here, not what's happening in Sucky Hall Street or Lothian Road or on a Saturday night. That the worrying trends are the if you like, the silent harm in those older age groups.
That's really interesting. And I went to a really good SHAP study day earlier this year where you spoke, Peter, and you made this point that although there were these sort of television ads making it sound like, you know, young women were most at risk, and they had these ads of what you call bench women. Actually, in reality, it's more like sofa man that we need to worry about here in Scotland. Could you explain that? I thought that was a really interesting point.
Yes, I mean, this became a bit of a trope in the alcohol policy world. There was a posed photograph of a model taken by a photo agency of you know, young women in a kind of cocktail dress sprawled on a park bench in a city centre, and this must have been used 1,000 times. I actually found the photo being used in Hungary and South Africa and Chile and all over the world.
Oh, wow.
But it was completely the wrong image. You know, she was young, she was female, it was public drinking, and the problem was intoxication, when all our trends were, let's say, men continue to dominate. It was chronic health harm, including liver disease, and it was home drinking. So, but you can, you know, it's understandable why a newspaper editor or website designer would use that photo rather than an old fella sitting on the couch watching Channel 4 racing with his bottle of vodka. But we had to do a lot of work to shift that. And we're fortunate in Scotland that we did at that time have policymakers who were willing to listen to that and make some pretty brave moves.
And, you know, we're thinking here about demographics. I've also read that although, you know, 20% of Scots are drinking to harmful levels, there's 19% of Scots who are teetotal, which really surprised me. And another thing that surprised me was to find out that more of those teetotal folk are from deprived communities rather than the least deprived. And I wonder, Alistair, if there's something you can say about what we know about drinking across the social strata here in Scotland.
It's a very important point, Rachel, and I'm glad you brought that up. There's something that the scientists call the alcohol harm paradox. If you look at the mean or the median consumption of alcohol, it's actually higher in the less deprived, the more wealthy areas. But in these areas, what you have is a lot of the population drinking in low or moderate levels. But in more deprived areas, you have actually a very high proportion, up to 30% are teetotal. But those that are drinking to huge excess, and that's where the harm occurs. And so, in fact, despite what I said about the median alcohol consumption, your chances of dying an alcohol death are several times higher if you live in a deprived community compared to a wealthy one. That gap has actually narrowed slightly. That's one bit of good news. At its worst, it was around 8 times. It's now 4 times. You're 4 times as likely to die an alcohol death if you're in a deprived community versus a well-off one.
So if I've got that right, actually, more alcohol is being consumed in the middle classes, but in the more deprived areas, you've got more extreme, either too much or none. But then overall, where the alcohol-specific deaths are happening, or maybe also the alcohol-contributed deaths, what was the word that you used?
Attributable.
Alcohol-attributable deaths overall are more in the deprived areas. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And if you wanted to just to extend that that sort of rather complicated fact a bit further, that's sometimes called polarisation, you know, with the extremes. Mm-hmm. And something very similar happened in COVID. One of the puzzles about COVID is that the total alcohol consumption during COVID didn't change that much. Obviously, it was all in the at home, as opposed to in the hospitality industry. Mm. And as Peter's already pointed out, that was a trend that was already happening in Scotland and the UK. But again, this polarisation happened where people were either, often moderate drinkers drank less during COVID or even stopped altogether, took the opportunity to stop. But if people were already drinking a bit too much during COVID, they drank an awful lot more than they should. Mm. And therefore the deaths went really through the roof, in fact.
Mm. That does resonate with what I've been seeing, I think, clinically. At the coalface, that those already drinking have come to more harm and are drinking more. You mentioned there has been some, you know, improvement on the inequality there, and I suspect that might be due to the minimum unit pricing policy. Is that right?
It may well have contributed. One of the very nice things about minimum unit pricing, which, remember what that is, that's where there's a floor price placed below which alcohol cannot be sold. And the great beauty of minimum unit price is that specifically targets the cheap alcohol, and it's the cheap alcohol that the heavy drinkers drink. So you actually have this policy which is nicely targeted at the heavy drinkers who are at most risk of harm. And so, since that's happening in your poorer communities, minimum unit price, unusually amongst public health policies, is a progressive policy in that it reduces health inequalities. Many public health policies are taken up by the wealthy middle classes, if you like, and that actually doesn't help health inequalities, but minimum unit price specifically reduces health inequalities.
And that's an important point, because I think a lot of critics, before it came out, were worried that this would be punitive to deprived communities, but in fact it has proven to reduce the deaths in deprived communities. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. When you look at the lives saved, the people that would have died had minimum unit price not been enacted, they're very much concentrated in the more deprived communities.
I'm quite interested to hear a little bit about the history of the policy, because you sort of alluded to the fact that you know the work started in 2012. But it was 2018, Peter, is that right, when it actually started for real?
Yes, well, and it was 2007 that SHAP first called for minimum unit price.
Wow, okay.
And that was really driven by, I think, what we were seeing in our clinics, that, you know, people were changing their drinking patterns. So when I kind of started in this field in the mid-80s, I guess, the consumption was dominated by super lagers, and the spirits consumption was mostly whiskey. And there were decent, you know, about half the patients you see would be pub drinkers, and that had changed a lot. So during this big increase in harm that Alistair was talking about, that coincided with a shift to home drinking, and then amongst the patients you saw a shift to cider, which had very favourable tax structure, so you could sell strong cider cheaper than you could sell strong beer.
Mm.
And it was very interesting to me, it really opened my eyes, these very loyal beer drinkers that you thought would stick with their Carlsberg Special, their Kestrel, their Tennent Super and Kestrel Black Label, shifted to White Lightning Cider. I can use that brand, it's not on the market anymore. But this was news to everyone, so the doctors were seeing it, and we were actually very important messengers about, you know, this is actually what's happening. I took a bottle of white cider into the Parliament in 2004, I think.
Wow,
and,
okay.
And passed it around the room. I don't know, security didn't ask me about this. I remember the MEPs, who were all on the health committee, there was an alcohol, looking at this stuff, and it was on them. was hiding in plain sight. It was in the bottom shelves of supermarkets. It was there. Mm. You didn't notice it unless you were going to look for it. Mm. And so we really emphasised that there are particular categories of alcohol that seem to be driving this, you know, increased, this epidemic of alcohol harm. So we said, and it was the cheapest alcohol. And now that wasn't only drunk by low income people. I spent the latter part of my career doing some work on the health of health professionals, mm. many of whom, you know, alcohol was at the heart. And you know, those doctors and other people in well paid jobs, they would migrate to the cheaper stuff. You know, they didn't stay on the on the expensive wine and malt whiskey. So, but as Alistair said, there was a particular weighting towards the low-income group. So we, if you like, that was a kind of clinical hunch. And then the modellers came in and we've had some really good work, with the University of Sheffield have, I guess, been the best known of that. Mm. And their modelling of, well, who buys what, how much do they drink of it, what kind of harm do they get from it, really supported our idea that it was the cheapest stuff that made the difference. So I think of it a bit like a slippery slope. It's a metaphor that's used a lot in our field. And so my thinking was, if you make the slope less steep and less slippery, that's well worth doing. Mm-hmm. And the very cheap alcohol made that slope steeper and more slippery, and we were trying to reverse that. And the outcomes have been pretty good. There's been a lot of international interest. As Alistair said, these policy measures, of course, happen in a very dynamic environment, including the pandemic. And so you need to... It's quite a complicated analysis, really, to look at the effect, because it's a moving target.
So if I've understood correctly, we made the minimum price for a unit of alcohol to be 50p... in 2018, and this year we've now updated that for inflation to 65p. Is that right?
That's correct. If I just go back a little bit, Rachel, you asked about that gap between 2012 and 2018.
Yes.
Now, actually, I think most of your listeners will know that the reason for that was because of a series of legal challenges from the alcohol industry, fronted by the Scotch Whisky Association. And Peter perhaps didn't talk about it, perhaps he'd be being a bit too modest, because I think we can claim that SHAP helped the government fight those legal challenges, and at each occasion the industry lost, and that's why it took so long. That's why, and of course, during those 6 years, many people died that would have not have died had MUP been introduced in 2012. Mm. Now, 50 pence was thought to be the right level on the basis of the modelling which Peter suggested in 2012. Mm-hmm. By 2018, 50p was already maybe quite cheap, you know, with the natural inflation. Luckily, over those years, inflation was at quite a low level. But as you know, in recent years, inflation has been significantly higher. And when we come to the current day, 50 pence is actually not what it was back even in 2018, far less 2012. So one of the important principles of minimum unit price is, if you introduce it at a set level but just leave it there, it will become progressively less effective over time. So I was very pleased that with heavy lobbying from SHAP, perhaps helping the government, were able to, in the face of some considerable opposition, get the uprating on the statute book this year, and we're now looking at a more reasonable level of 65p, which, to be honest, is roughly the same level as it would have been, as 50 pence would have been in 2018. It's not a big increase, it's just a readjustment. What we would really like would be for there to be a regular uprating in relation to inflation. That would avoid these arguments every few years.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, what's going to happen in the future?
Well, if you could... If I could have one biggest win for SHAP, I think it would be to persuade the government to have a regular uprating, whatever that mechanism may be, rather than leaving it static for a number of years. Mm. And of course, the longer you leave it, the bigger the increase is necessary, and the more controversial that will be. Mm. There are many examples of taxes and duty which increase on a regular basis, and I would love to see that in place.
Peter, I want to come again to, you know, the alcohol industry, because I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to explore further. But just before we do, I guess something to the layperson like me who's rather ignorant about all this, when you start talking about minimum pricing, I guess I start to worry, well, if people are addicted to that amount of alcohol and it just gets more expensive, do they then end up in financial ruin trying to maintain that amount of alcohol? Or does the evidence suggest that they just drink less? Is that, do we know that?
We don't know as much about that as we would like, but I think we, when the measure came in the first full year, there was about a 10% fall in alcohol-specific mortality, and that would only have happened if, you know, there were
drinking
if,
less.
If there hadn't been changes amongst the very heaviest drinkers.
Mm.
Addiction, and I say this as somebody who's spent my life working in that field, is a pretty slippery concept. Some pretty good analysis of primary care activity in Scotland. They found about 20% of consultations were, could conceivably be alcohol related. So people with anxiety, people with poor sleep, with fatigue, after accidents. It was interesting to me actually how much work there was of that, and actually how little work would have been a traditional gastroenterology presentation. They're pretty unusual. Mm. You'll know that. That was a surprise to me. So, and I think there was a lot of work done at that time to develop a training programme, which was delivered by RCGP Scotland in large part, just on raising these issues and encouraging behaviour change. And one of the enjoyable things about that programme is that primary care, so it applied actually to lots of things, to exercise regime, to weight control, to taking medication when you're supposed to, because an awful lot of health work is trying to persuade people to change their behaviour, and they don't always do it, and actually having a bit of a kind of science and theoretical framework through it, and this was mostly through an approach called motivational interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
Now some people were naturals at that, and actually if you look back at the development of motivational interviewing, it was from practitioners that just intuitively had good outcomes because they handled the consultation in a way that encouraged patients to feel optimistic and effective in what they might do, and other people with training then improved that. So the consultation skills that general practice spends a lot of time training actually are very useful here. The reflective listening, the active listening, the feedback, the selective, what do you emphasise, what do you not emphasise, and all of that.
Mm.
So that, I think it was a very interesting process being involved in that training. So, yeah, that's the, you know, consultation skills are absolutely key to this.
I think that it's quite interesting to hear the history behind ABI, alcohol brief interventions, because when I graduated as a GP in 2017, I was told, click this button when you speak to someone about alcohol so we can get paid. And actually, although it's easy to be cynical about that, that actually did work, because I had in my head that it was good for the practice, good for the patient to click this button. I didn't feel I could click the button unless I had brought up the subject of alcohol. And so actually pretty effective. I mean, I hear now that we don't get paid much for it, and it's quite a small number that we have to do. And so I'm probably clicking the button when it's no longer really financially going to bring any benefit. But I think it did get me as a GP trainee into the habit of considering alcohol. So tell me a bit about ABI then. How did it come about? Was there training for GPs at the time? Was it all about the motivational interviewing from like Steve Rosnick and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it, yes, as I say, there'd been quite a long research tradition, but it really hadn't been a bit of a trial in Sweden to get a national programme going. But yes, it was really part of the, if you like, a multi-action alcohol programme from government, including minimum unit price and some bans on marketing and so on. But there's also investment in specialist treatment and in early intervention. And it was very interesting to me just actually how well that worked, and actually how quickly primary care turned turned around if the incentives were there, the training and the financial incentives, compared to trying to get things to change in secondary care, which are just kind of impossible. So primary care is actually very impressive, actually, how quickly the programme got going. And yeah, it was based on motivational interviewing. Steve Rolnick actually worked in the unit where I worked in Montrose,
oh,
in Somerset,
wow,
Royal Hospital as a student, so I got to know Steve pretty well. And actually the first motivational interviewing training was pioneered in Montrose, believe it or not. But it was, I think, great actually to see the programme roll out. And I think the thing that made the difference was it was one of four health improvement targets, I think, that the government wanted to implement. So when the Cabinet Secretary went round and met with Health Board Chief Executive, she asked them about cancer waiting time, she asked them about A&E weight, she asked them about whatever else might be breastfeeding rates, and she asked them about alcohol brief interventions. So that really put us in the big league. So from being just one of a big long list of things, that it would be nice if primary care would give priority to, it actually moved it up the agenda, and the financial incentives and the monitoring was a very important part of that. So general practice has changed, and those tricks and techniques that worked, whatever, 15 years ago, probably, you know, might not work now. But it was a programme which worked well. We did some evaluation in SHAP of that, and it seemed to be a combination of the training, a combination of the government priority, a combination of the financial incentives, a combination. Getting the software altered was very important, so it did pop up on your screen.
So they click the button. It makes you feel you've done something.
And it was well accepted. We did not have, you know, people storming out of surgeries all over Scotland, mm-hmm, saying they were offended. They understood why alcohol was important to their
mm-hmm
health.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, and this may be a bit of an idealised view of general practice, I hope it isn't, but you know, if somebody has known their GP a long time, they go in and speak to them, concerned about their sleep or concerned about their weight gain or whatever, and their you know, doctor says one thing might be relevant here is your drinking. Can you just talk me through what your, you know, kind of a typical day or week is like for you? What was important? Because I think a very important thing to remember is that heavy drinkers tend to mix with each other and tell each other that they're normal. So I think just some simple orientation, you know, do you realise you are, mm-hmm, you know, drinking at levels that create risk, can be a powerful intervention. Of course, you don't win them all, you never do, but it's well worth doing. And certainly the development of that programme is a very interesting thing to one of the most interesting things I've done in my career was that programme.
Well, I think, you know, it did work, actually, because I didn't know any of the history of it. I didn't know what ABI was, but I knew there was this button and that I should press it, and it did get me to bring up the subject. And yeah, and I found that went okay, actually, when I did. Very interesting that you knew Steve Rolnick, because when we teach medical students the basics of motivational interviewing, I use a video of his online, and I try to break down motivational interviewing so it's not just this waffly subject, but the very specific techniques like reflecting back ambivalence or teasing out sort of there may be someone's conflicting feelings and reality, or asking how confident they are that they might be able to make the change, and trying to evoke that kind of hope talk or change talk. So I think actually, although it might be easy to be cynical about ABI, I think it probably did help us all. I don't know what you're imagining now in a post-quaff GP era, where we do have a little less continuity with our patients. What's going to come next if it's no longer ABI? Are we keeping ABI, or what's SHAP thinking is next?
Well, I think we're not quite sure which direction the government will take. One of SHAP's steering group members, Liz Smart, chaired a review of the ABIs. It's clear that the number of ABIs, which peaked at about over 100,000 a year in Scotland, I think around 2014, has been steadily falling since then. It's around 70,000 now, and less of those in the priority areas, such as primary care. So it's clear that maybe a refresh is needed, perhaps for all the reasons you're saying. And I must say that I find the conclusions of that group, and I've got them in front of me here, I can say that they wish the Scottish Government to reaffirm its commitment to the ABI programme and to reorient it to be flexible and evidence-informed. They have set out the steps, if you like, whereby they could embed these conversations, and they want engagement from the movers and shakers, if you like, the chief medical officer, the chief nursing officer, college of midwives. Now, that's all grand talk, but it's not very specific. So, you know, you spoke about the value of financial incentives. You know, I think there has to be a way to prioritise it. There is a move to say that, partly because of the success of ABIs, that it can be applied more generally. You know, you pointed out about motivational interviewing, whether it be exercise or weight loss or whatever. And that's all very well, and I would like it to be normalised, but I'm worried if we lose the specificity, it won't be measurable, and therefore it won't be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, it also makes me think about other research that I read done by SHAP, sort of qualitative research focus groups with people in recovery, and it was really about stigma. And the points made that I read were that, you know, one of the barriers that folk in recovery identified was the stigma that they felt or perceived from healthcare staff. And that how we talk about alcohol, therefore, does affect the shame that people are already feeling. And one of the points was that an over kind of focus on counting units of alcohol was felt to be rather impersonal and medical, and it contributed to stigma. And I found that quite challenging, because on one hand it seems sensible to bring up the subject and maybe help folk calculate units and be somehow scientific and objective about it so that we can talk about it without being personal. But then on the other hand, I was reading this, you know, a qualitative research saying that often folk felt more judged by their GPs if we overfocus. So I don't know what to say in response to that.
Stigma is a very difficult area to try and make inroads. I think that you may well be right, that if you make it colder and more scientific rather than empathetic and warmer and natural in the conversation, that will turn people off. I think perhaps a bigger problem in relation to stigma is the sort of things we've been talking about today in terms of being poorly informed. If your expectation is that nothing can be done, then that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If even unconsciously you believe that this person's illness is their own fault, then you'll be less inclined to be sympathetic towards them. No, I'm not suggesting for a second that every heavy drinker is an easy patient to have. Mm. You know, my wife's an ex-GP, I understand the difficulties. Mm. But the things which help are empathy, continuity, understanding, and knowledge. And I think one of the things that this sort of podcast can do is improve knowledge. If you understand that things can be done and things can get better, that's a good step in the right direction in terms of reducing healthcare stigma, which is a real thing.
Mm. Yes, and I think if we, you know, go back to Medicine 101 and us all learning about that, the presenting complaint is absolutely central here. You know, what's this person worried about? Are they worried about the poor sleep? Are they, you know, worried about abdominal pain? Are they worried about anxiety? And, you know, it's only, I think, relevant to raise alcohol if you genuinely think it's going to be relevant to the things that the patients are worried about. So I think if we keep ourselves orientated that way, in that old traditional presenting complaint kind of way, you won't go far wrong. But the stigma issue is substantial, and the self-stigma that you mentioned is important. And so I think if we orientate ourselves by trying to help that individual with the thing they're concerned about, you won't go far wrong.
I think also there's that question of hope. I think that once you see some patients take on board that alcohol is contributing to their symptoms and change their behaviour, no matter how hard that is, and then feel better for it, that gives us as primary care clinicians hope that things can get better, that people can make changes to improve. And so hopefully in this series, talking to folk in recovery will help engender that as well. That I think feeling futile probably contributes to stigma, because if I'm sort of going into a consult feeling it's all a bit of a lost cause anyway, I can see how that sort of sets me up already to maybe give off a stigma vibe.
Yes, and we need to remember as doctors who it is that we see. I remember a conversation with a friend and colleague of mine who was an emergency medicine doctor in Tayside, who said, I've not seen Jimmy so-and-so for ages, you know, this poor guy, he's probably died. And I said, no, he's attending my clinic and he's sober.
Yeah.
And so Bill hadn't seen him for weeks when he had been a regular attendee. But the one outcome he did not think had happened was that he'd recovered.
Interesting.
So
yeah.
We see, and I was lucky in my specialist practice, you see a lot of people recover. Now, I never know if general practice probably wouldn't thank me for this, but I would say, why don't you just pop in and see your GP, you know, once a year, just to go, hello, I'm here. Now, I'm sure you'd feel you have other things to do, but actually that would maybe help, because, of course, you see a lot of the people who are not doing well, and you don't see the people who are doing well. So, but that raising of expectations is important in policy terms as well. I think with SHAP, we managed to get doctors involved because they saw there was actually an opportunity to improve things, rather than, well, these are all nice ideas but you're never going to get anywhere. So I think actually that kind of raising expectations is very important at an individual level and on a population and a policy level as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually when I was training under a consultant psychiatrist at the Royal Ed as part of my GP training, and he always made a consistent question about alcohol in his consults, and I sort of queried what the point of this is, because surely everyone knew that they should drink less, why go on about it? And he said, on the contrary, not everyone does know that alcohol is a depressant, and our role as a doctor is to make sure that they are at least making an informed decision to start with, and that he had seen plenty of patients take on board advice and cure their depression by stopping alcohol. Mm. And just that one conversation we had has stayed with me, 7 years later, and I still try to repeat that to patients. So, yeah, I think that's true. As GPs, we tend to see people when there's a problem, and we don't necessarily see the success.
And perhaps it's worth remembering, we're slightly focusing here on the more severe end. We've spoken about prevention in terms of public health policies. We're now in the surgery with the heavy drinker. But this whole field is a spectrum. You know, those conversations you have with the person with hypertension, the ABI on the person in some other context, you may well influence their future health, just in the same way as checking somebody's blood pressure and getting them on medication may well influence their future health. So it's not just about treating the end stage disease, whether that be addiction or liver disease. It's about picking up the problem at an early stage.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that might be a good place for us to end, unless there's anything either of you particularly wanted to say to primary care clinicians listening.
Don't forget liver disease.
No, don't forget liver disease. And, there's been big changes in primary care. The pandemic brought huge huge impacts on primary care practice. But back to think about the brief intervention programme in Scotland. When we looked at, if you're wanting to do something that gets in touch with a huge chunk of the population, primary healthcare is the place to do it. Far more than housing departments, far more than criminal justice, far more than social work. Your listeners will probably know better than me the number of people who, the proportion of people who see their GP. So it's a fantastic system, primary care. There are lots of places around the world. It's a very high priority for WHO is to establish universal healthcare, you know, throughout the world. So it's really important not to take it for granted. It's an absolutely, of course, it's a vital public service, but for this area, particularly if you're looking to, you know, get to the very broad populations that we're talking about, primary care is central to that. It's trusted, it's admired by people, you know.
And GPs. If your GP isn't going to raise it, who is?
Exactly. Well, better your GP than a police officer.
Well, that's ideal. Yes, you're right. Let's leave it there. That's super. Thank you so much to both of you for joining me and for clarifying really quite complex things. That's been really interesting to hear about the policy and the history, things that often when we're really busy at the coalface, we don't have time to even know about. So thank you very much to you both.
Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.